Welcome to Geek Nerd Tech on Black Hollywood Live today. What's wrong with self-driving cars? Jeff Bezos wears a robo suit and Deadpool gets a trailer. That's all.
You are tuned in to Black Hollywood Live's Geek Nerd Tech.
Yeah. I couldn't get a bill paid. You couldn't buy the real thing. I was staying up at your place.
Drake.
Trying to figure out the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I saw people doing things.
Welcome to Geek Nerd Tech, the show we break down tech news and their culture from a black and brown geek perspective. I'm Joe Braswell. I'm joined as always by Keely Shine. What's up, sir?
What's good, man?
How you doing?
Doing pretty well, my man.
Apologies for missing last week, folks. We took a week off following South by Southwest, but we'll try to get some South by Southwest recaps in there, even though it's a week late, and we'll go on, you know, from there and talk about some other stuff. But new Drake, I mean, it just feels like Drake and Rick Ross are incredibly prolific. It seems like they drop a new record every 6 months, every 4 to 6 months. Am I wrong about that, or does it seem that way?
No, I mean, I definitely think the lifespan of records are obviously much smaller now in the digital era, and therefore, you know, you want to get back in the cycle of producing your record much quicker. I mean, you know, in the 90s and, you know, 2000, you could expect a record like once a year from an artist. Now artists are dropping them.
Yeah, for the big ones.
Now they're dropping it like, I mean, you look at Future, he dropped two albums in the same 3 month window. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So, but I think this Drake record is pretty amazing in the sense that it's shattering all records on both Spotify and Apple Music. It holds the record for the most downloads. Like, I mean, Drake is killing it, you know.
So do you, that all may be true, but what do you think of the actual? Have you guys yet spent time with actual music yet?
Yeah, it's decent.
Decent?
It's decent.
Like decent meaning like, okay, he's still doing Drake stuff, or like it's decent, like above average?
I mean, I think Drake is generally above average. Okay. So, you know, I think anything he does is going to be.
So you hold Drake already at a spot that's above average. So you expect him to meet a certain bar every time, and for you, when it's meeting the Drake bar, it's going to be great. It's going to be good.
Yeah, I think at his worst, it's going to kill most of what's out. So yeah. I think Drake is very talented. You know, I mean, I think sometimes he's hit or miss. Sometimes, you know, the record is, you know, for a particular niche.
Right.
But overall, I think he's a pretty phenomenal artist.
I would have to agree with all of that. Drake doesn't change. What changes is my personal sort of, like, tolerance for what I think Drake is doing or not doing. But, you know, like, I'm like everyone else. I'm like, Drake! F Drake! And I'm like, Drake! And I'm like, forget Drake! So, and meanwhile, Drake's doing the same shit, so. It's not really anybody's fault.
Numbers don't lie.
I do want to ask you on this topic. What do you think is better? Do you think it's better for the artist to take that time and let the fans let the want for a new record like Jay-Z or the folks, you know, let the anticipation build and then drop something every 18 months to 2 years, or do you think things should come fairly consistently every year, every 6 months? And what's it to not get out of the public eye?
I mean, I think it's the fundamental question of, you know, artistry versus commerce. I mean, obviously you want to drop as quickly as possible because you want to make as much money as possible and captivate your audience, you know, once you have them. But in terms of like the artistic foundation of it, I think, you know, when you go back into like the whole Stax and Motown era when they were really in there crafting the records and taking their time to like make sure every harmony and every song lyric was perfect and every drum snare and drum kick was locked in. Like, I feel like that type of sophistication is missing in records because of the technology. And so, sure. I think from an artistic perspective, I would love for an artist to be in the cocoon and come out with something amazing and not just be so, you know, not so worried about the marketing and the commercial elements of what it goes into now creating, you know, music for audiences. So
that is interesting when it comes to technology and how that has changed. You would hear these stories about, you know, certain producers spending literally like, you know, I spent 48 hours trying to get a snare right on a drum, trying to record a snare just right on a real snare, trying to get that sound just right. Whereas now, you know, with all the technology, people are at home on their laptops, press a button, and that's the snare they want. They figure out that snare within, you know, a few minutes.
And not just that, it's uploaded onto, you know, Apple Music, Spotify immediately.
Right.
You know, there's no
don't take it to the factory, pressing the records out.
Yeah, there's no distribution chain.
Distribution mechanism. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, trucks rolling, this Tower Records. That's all that. Yeah. All that is gone. Well, it's really interesting. I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's as long as, look, there's artists who are always super prolific, Prince being one. Prince was always super prolific. You know, he'd do like whatever 100 songs every time, you know, a year, whatever. But then would only release a record, at least in the heyday, every couple of years.
Right.
So not everything made it out. So sometimes it makes you wonder, should everything make it out? Like, I listen to the Future record, I'm like, okay,
definitely not.
You know, I mean, Future's got 40 songs, you know, maybe like 6 hot ones. I don't know.
I mean, I don't think in any artistic category, everything makes it out. If I'm a writer, I'm not going to release all my writings. Like,
right.
I'm only going to, you know, funnel out the best of the best. And maybe if I, you know, die tragically or I become a legend, then people want to see those other things that I wrote that may not have been commercially suitable at the time, but now are commercially suitable because
right.
of whatever the legacy is, you know.
Right. Interesting. So. All right. Well, that's always an interesting art versus commerce, and as where it meets technology as it pertains to music and other things as well. I mean, you're hearing similar things with television as well. I mean, like with these networks, like Netflix, are just nonstop,
yeah.
cranking stuff out.
Exactly.
Anyway, so we move on. So a couple of things that have been happening both Google. Google's under fire for you know, some of their ads. There's some government ads on hate videos that surfaced in other parts of the world and in here. There's one with David Duke. There's one. There's a UK ad, sort of the British Nationalist Party called Britain First. An organization of Polish nationalists. These are extreme, like, right wing people, hate preachers. Have stuff. David Duke, have these things end up on Google, YouTube's advertising, and they're kind of slipping through the cracks. And people are freaking out about that. I mean, this is the part where the freedom of the internet and the lack of oversight of the internet, you know, meets, you know, freedom of speech. I don't know. What do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a company's perspective, you know, you have this clean image that you are presenting to the public of what your company is supposed to represent, and then right alongside of that are imagery or messaging points that completely contradict that. And I think it's very confusing, not only to the person that is consuming that information, and I think it could be detrimental in terms of a brand and how a person might view that brand, being that it's aligned, you know, visibly, you know, within the same kind of frame. And so I think that YouTube, Google have a responsibility to not just the, you know, the audience and the people that consume the content, but the people that are actually presenting their products and trying to sell their products. I think there has to be some type of way to curate it much better so that there's no type of crossfire of that type of stuff. I feel like, yeah, freedom of speech, if you want to, you know, say all that crap, you know, whatever your positions are, whatever your philosophies are, I think it should go into a particular silo, particular
yeah.
category. I don't think it should be blended in with, you know, Dove, or blended in with, I think the company was L'Oreal,
right,
or whatever. But that's my take on it.
I mean, I agree too, but it's just interesting because, you know, how do you, I mean, there's people who may argue out there that I'm minding my own business, I don't want to see you know, the Dove commercial with a bunch of naked women, you know, on my YouTube feed. Maybe I wanted to see something else, you know, like, you know, why? There's a lot when it comes
Turn
to advertising.
The
right, when it comes to advertising, though, and especially some of these autoplays on YouTube specifically, mm-hmm. like, you don't have a choice. You have to watch what you're seeing.
You have a choice.
You see a video.
You have a choice. You can go look at something else while it plays.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
You don't have to, like,
you have to sit there and watch it.
Yeah, no one's forcing you to do that.
Right. That's a good point.
Still a choice.
All right. That's a good point. All right. We'll see. So Google's really upset about this, and it appears to be saying all the right things about not having this sort of thing on there. But again, it just begs the question of, you know, this is at Google's discretion still. So who's setting these terms? Who's setting these boundaries? These rules? There's no oversight. It's really up to the individual corporation, Google, Facebook, Snapchat.
I think it's an algorithm problem. I think they just need to figure out, you know, a better way of the curation process and just
right.
how, you know, stuff is placed. And I think, I mean, obviously they've done
right.
an amazing job. They're the best in the game to do it. I mean, they
right.
started doing it. I just think they need to tighten up on it, especially with the polarizing times that we're in and
right.
how we all have the phones and able to produce our own content, and just the proliferation of just more and more content, just how we can better, you know, curate everyone's experience so that it's healthy and positive and fruitful for everyone.
Yeah, and it seems like, it's, I agree, that's what I thought, but it does seem like there's room for people to subvert that, like, you know, so you start to you have a commercial that's like, you know, do you enjoy soap? Do you enjoy white soap? Because this is the whitest. So, like, there's a way to sort of subvert that, but I hear you. I agree. I mean, people are smart. And
yeah,
figure it all out. Speaking of which, so speaking of Google, I'm completely mixed on this. So Google and Levi have finally unveiled their smart jacket, right. Levi's. This is something they've been talking about for a while, long, like a cool minute. Like, it's this the smart jacket technology has been out for a while. They just debuted it at South by Southwest. It is essentially a normal looking jacket,
right?
Yeah, just describe it. It just wears like a normal jacket, but it has weird Bluetooth fiber sewn into the jacket itself, and you can do all kinds of things, like answer your phone, start your Spotify playlist, check other things on your phone by your jacket. So the examples they use is, are people are riding their bike, and you can like sort of swipe on your swipe on your jacket to be the I think the technology as it is described is cool. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting though, like, to see how this works in real life, because there's no buttons or anything.
Right.
It's like gestures, almost like the two fingers on your mouse or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you're like, you know, let me answer the phone. Like, let me do this. You know, I don't know. Let me... Healy. Like, I don't know. it's like there's all these weird things you have to do, but I guess it's cool. I'm really on the fence with it. What do you think of this?
Oh, I mean, I think that this particular iteration of it is pretty gimmicky, but I get that, you know, we're in the era of wearables, and wearables becoming a fashion statement, and then going, you know, further with that statement, saying that wearables are fashion, right, or blending fashion with technology. So, I mean, I get it. And I mean, I don't think that I would drop the $400 or whatever amount it costs for the jacket Bluetooth integrated into my. I think that's a bit much. Like, but I mean, I think conceptually. I mean,
is there a practical use for that?
I mean, I think that, you know, maybe from like a from an adolescent perspective, you came with a jacket that, you know, did all that. I think that would be cool. It would have some type of cool factor to it, but I don't see that as something that is. Can be adopted in mass. You know, I think that the technology will get better over time, and we'll figure out better ways to integrate, you know, smartphone technology into our fashion, or maybe even our biology. But right. I think that this, like I said, this iteration of it, I think it's pretty much a gimmick.
It sounds like a gimmick, because I've been walking up like, what's up, Achille? You're like, well, hold on.
Right. you just activated my...
like, that's... I don't know. It's I don't... You know, we'll see. It seems gimmicky. I just need to see it. I need to see, maybe to see more of how it makes sense. But the jackets look cool, but to pay an extra $399 or whatever for the jacket, to have it wired to my phone so I can do a little move and answer something. I don't know that I need that.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Moving on to, we were talking a lot about Uber and Uber's trials and tribulations. Uber president Jeff Jones is now stepping down.
President?
Yeah, the president, not CEO. Oh, gotcha. CEO Travis Kalanick is still running Uber, and he's still doing his thing. But, I mean, it just feels like he's stepping out of concerns of the firm's management culture. It seems like this is a bit, he's a bit of a sacrificial lamb, you know, because they've got a lot of heat over the days with the delete Uber campaigns, and then a lot of things are going on. So what they've done
is... And also the sexual harassment.
That's a big one in the management culture. So he is stepping down. I guess this is a way, I'm sure with a lot of money, but this is sort of a way... I mean, someone's got to go when stuff happens like this. Heads got to roll for the public to see, like, oh, it was this guy. Okay, now Uber's got all behind. They're cleaning house. First of all, do you buy it? And second of all, do you think it'll help them?
No, I definitely agree with your analysis that, you know, somebody has to fall on the sword. And so I guess this is the fall guy. But I don't buy it. And I think, you know, by one guy, you know, being, you know, extracted from the Uber culture does not change the culture.
Yeah. It's a large company. It's $86 billion company, whatever. You can't tell me one dude is, you know, changing the entire culture.
And I guess, you know, from a symbolic point of view, you know, they think that this is maybe a first step, hopefully of many. But, you know, I think that Uber, I mean, it's kind of like a domino effect. Like one negative thing happens, and, you know, it kind of opens up the opens up a vacuum of other negative things. And I think they're still in that vacuum. They're still in that storm of negativity. And especially, you know, with other, you know, apps, you know, that are, you know, in competition with Uber. I mean, it gives them perfect opportunity to kind of get more market share.
Yep.
And so I think that, I think Uber is still a powerhouse by no means. Like, is anyone going to dethrone them? But I think that, you know, they need something extra. Maybe it's a self-driving car that they're developing, but they need something that's going to, like, bring a positive light to what they're doing.
Do you think they need something, do you think that positive light is something more, is it something that's sort of whiz-bang from a technology standpoint, like Uber is innovating, or something that is more sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, not altruistic, but just something that's more, you know, PR friendly, like, you know, Uber gives rides to kids, or is it something that's going to, like, change the culture from a PR standpoint, like, we're not bad, we're good, or is it just something purely technology that's going to just going to change people's minds?
I mean, I would hope that any company, you know, has the altruistic, you know, elements built into their DNA.
Right.
But I think Uber...
Not always.
Yeah, not always. But I think Uber is probably closer than Apple or closer than Google to actually fulfilling the vision of self-driving vehicles. I think they're the closest. And I think they have the global network and the infrastructure to be able to do that.
Right.
So I think once they do that, I think people will be like, oh, this shit is dope. Like, Uber's dope. You know, I think it'll change the perception again.
I agree. Okay. So here's something I want to ask you about, because I am so behind on this stuff. And it's been a long time. It's way in our rearview mirrors since we were at CES together, like, almost 3 years ago, when my mind was blown by the TVs I was seeing at CES 3 years ago, almost 3.5 years ago. Sony's unveiling the OLED 4K TV. It's starting at $5,000. What's going on with this TV? Do I need to buy it? Is it as advertised? $5,000 is a lot of money. What's your take?
I mean, my personal take, well, I have two takes. I think from a technology perspective, I think just the advancements that are being made in the home theater category, I think, are amazing. Like, the experience that you can have in your home now with sound, with video, I think is unparalleled. And it's almost like, I mean, some might argue that they would not go to a movie theater to experience it. They can just do it in their living room.
Right.
But I think for me personally, I'm not trying to spend $5,000 for a TV. But I appreciate going to the movies. I like watching content on my mobile devices. I think I have a 4K TV. Like, it's not really earth-shattering. It's not really changing my experience. Like, I think maybe when there's more content that's available and that becomes more of a standard, then, you know, I think that would be fresh. I love the fact, though, how the sound in this TV doesn't come from below the television. Like, there's not speakers below or on the sides.
Right.
The sound actually is projected from the TV, from the screen of the TV. And I think that's highly sophisticated.
That's ridiculous.
So, I don't even know what that sounds like.
I don't know what that's supposed to be. I don't know how that even works.
But the thought of it just sounds pretty awesome.
Right.
So.
I love it. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, it looks great. I think I need to go back and just, you know, I think I'm gonna, you know, I think this year is my year for TV shopping. So maybe I've waited long enough to sort of see what's
what.
Yeah, you
get you a 4K TV for minimal cost now.
Wow, that's good. And then the whole 8K technology, is that something that we should be caring about? Or is it like 4K was 4 years ago?
I mean, I think as filmmakers, yeah. I mean, because, I mean, they have 10K, they have 16K, you know,
right.
Especially in Japan. You know, I think they even used some 8K broadcast for the Olympics over the summer, last summer.
Right.
So I think, you know, as we evolve, like, you know, 4K will become obsolete, just like 1080 is now becoming obsolete.
Right.
But yeah, like, obviously more clarity, more colors, more precision. But I think, like I said, as filmmakers, that's important to us because we can archive our footage. If we shoot something in 8K now, and then when the technology adopts 5-10 years from now, and now there's 8K, and we can reformat our 8K content to what's
right.
current. You know, if we shoot 8K now, we can scale down to 4K. So I think in terms of how you leverage the higher res content for production standpoint, I think it's great. But from a consumer standpoint, I think it's meaningless.
I want to ask you about. While we're here, I just want to ask you about sort of what's happening back to the commercial DVD world and the entertainment world. I mean, you know, for a long time, studios would make a ton of money off VHS and a ton of money off the DVD world. I mean, for years and years and years, those DVD numbers were huge. Then it started to dry up. The Blu-ray numbers were starting to be okay, but now with the proliferation of streaming and digital and Apple TV and all that stuff, those are going away. But what you are seeing is a new re-release of a lot of these things on Ultra HD. You know, like, I bought every iteration of his movies. I bought, like, five versions of, you know, I bought the VHS, and I bought the DVD, and I bought the special edition DVD, and I bought the Blu-ray, and I bought the box set, and I bought the thing. And now, I'm like, do I need to get, like, a Star Wars, where you have I have 10 versions of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Now Star Wars is an Ultra UHD. Do I need to buy that? Like, what are they doing to my same print of Star Wars?
I think a lot of that is kind of like pony and dance, you know. Right. I think it's marketing. But if you love the franchise or you love the property that much and you want it part of your collection, if you're a hobbyist or a collector, right, then it makes sense. But I'd rather just stream it, you know. I'd rather just stream the legacy content if it's available. And if it's something, like I said, if it's something that I really like and I want part of my collection, I might drop the 20 or 30 or whatever it costs to get it. But
can you stream it at that crazy quality? And does that quality make a difference?
I mean, Netflix offers 4K.
Yeah.
Like, you just got to pay, I think it's $10 instead of $8.
Right.
I think Amazon does the same thing. Like, the content is offered for sure.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
That's interesting. Okay, I'm just curious as to what I'm paying for and if it's worth me paying for it. Is it worth me owning it versus streaming it or downloading it? But yeah. That makes sense. Okay, this is something that is really not even really news, but I liked it. Jeff Bezos wore a big robot suit. I don't think it's a big deal, but I just thought it was cool. You guys, there was a South Korean company, Hankook Mirai Technology. They have this giant robot, 14 feet tall, a la Titan AE, or most notably Aliens. And you know, it looked cool as hell. This is everyone, even Avatar. I think Avatar had one of those too. Mm-hmm. At the end of Avatar. Yeah. So James Cameron's a guy who's noted for, like, you know, creating these things into our popular culture, and then subsequently they've shown up in a ton of video games, from Halo to Titan AE. But there's something about these type of mechs that and just capture the imagination, and to see Jeff Bezos in one, it's crazy. You know? I don't know. I thought that's cool. I mean, I don't know what you do with it or what they do with it, if it's construction or whatever. But you know, he just said he feels like Sigourney Weaver in Aliens. But there is a hashtag Mars 2017, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's a joke play on words there, but what do you think of this?
I mean, it does have a cool factor to it. It's awesome that, you know, a CEO of such a large company can, you know, not take himself so seriously and hop in a robot and be like, you know, wave the arms and go crazy.
Right.
I think that's kind of cool. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this technology we see in Japan, where they have the actual robot wars, where they actually fight them.
Yeah.
You know, they build them and fight them. So, I mean, who knows, like, you know, how this will be leveraged for, you know, when we try to colonize Mars or another planet. But like, maybe this is how we, you know, transport ourselves once we land on a moon or a planet.
Right.
But yeah, I think Jeff Bezos, I mean, you see him at the Oscars, you see him in a robot. Like, I mean, he's kind of fresh. Can't knock him.
I'm not mad at him at all. He's great. Good for him. All right. So Germany, this is sort of piggybacking on the story we did earlier about Google. But so Germany's is considering a huge fine for social media companies that fail to remove hate speech. You know, Facebook and Twitter are, like, there's stuff that pops up on Facebook and Twitter that is clearly hate speech. It feels like it's taking a long time for Facebook and Twitter to get this stuff down. This is in places like the U.S. It's great, but it's tough enough in the U.S. But places like Germany, where you have a huge proliferation of neo-Nazis and other kind of hate folks, they have a zero tolerance for this sort of thing in their country. So they're trying to have a zero tolerance for this sort of thing in their social media. So they're trying to do a 50 million euro fine. Do you think that'll get someone's attention?
Oh yeah, I think so. And I think it even cited that whoever is in charge of taking down, you know, hate statements, whatever person holds that position, they're saying also that they will fine that person. Like, they will, not just the company, they will fine that person.
Right.
Oh. I think that is pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. Because, you know, if you need to get your hate speech out, hopefully you have the $50 million to pay for it.
Wow.
I mean, you know, That's interesting.
Yeah, but I don't understand how that. I mean, how do you think that they'll be able to manage that? How would that be regulated? How do they tell someone like Facebook, cough up the money? Like you didn't take down these posts. Like, how does that work?
That I think that is the part where, as always with the internet, where there's the problem. I think there's a lot of like, you know, this is the thing. Like, there's so many, like, you know, people are still trying to figure out how to regulate an unregulated a space that can't be regulated.
Right.
So, and you have these private corporations who have to adhere to some people, but then again, they don't because the internet is not a sovereign nation. The internet is not, you know, there's no borders in the internet.
Right.
So how do you govern the internet? You know, whether you're a company or you're a consumer or you're Germany.
Right.
So I don't know. Like, the only thing you can do is really crack down. Like Germany's able to do is maybe crack down on some of the telecom, the way this stuff is sent and received, because some of the country still does control a lot of the fiber and the cable and the telecom, the way things are going back and forth. But I don't know, man. I have no idea. That's a tough one. that's a tough one. I have no idea. So we'll see. It could be all bluster, but you know, we'll see how they can actually enforce that.
Yeah.
So this is a company that's on Kickstarter that's coming out with a phone called the CM Pro, and it's based around the idea that we have too distracted, too many apps. I know I've got like over like 100 and some apps on my phone, too much everything. These guys are saying I'm gonna have a phone that just basic features. It's gonna have phone calls, messaging, Google Maps, and that's it. Contacts on a clock. Good night. There's something really appealing. I'm gonna say there's something really appealing about this as an option. That being said, you can do that yourself. I can just delete all the apps on my phone and just have a clock, you know, if I wanted to. But what do you think of this?
Again, I think this is another gimmick product. I think maybe for someone that has an addictive personality or has a actual problem with, you know, their connectivity to their devices, this might be helpful.
Right.
But I think as, you know, something that is like widely accepted and used, definitely not. It's ridiculous.
Right.
Like, come on. You should be able to self-monitor yourself. You should be able to say, hey, you know, I've been on my phone or my iPad or my computer way too long, or I need some time just to reflect, go outside, have a conversation, get a cup of coffee, take a walk. Like, you shouldn't have to buy another product to help you do that. It's
right.
Ridiculous.
Right. It's just true. Yeah, it's true. But this is I don't know. It's weird because I think that, you know, some people, you can't underestimate people's ability to want things done for them.
I guess.
I mean, because guys like me and you, like, just delete the apps on your phone. Other people are like, it's just easier if I just have the one button.
Okay.
So this entire industry is made off of like lazy people like that. So who knows? We'll see. I tend to agree with you. I think it's very gimmicky, but at the same time, I don't think it won't be a success.
Well, you would buy some stocks from that company?
No.
Okay, then.
But let me put it this way: I would be surprised if it turns out to be a success.
All right.
Like I'm not really good at predicting this stuff. I mean, this is like something that you know, billionaire Chris Sacca talks about all the time. Like all the things he missed out on, like Instagram. He's like, Instagram, no one wants that. That's you know, that's a photo book. It's already doing that. That's ridiculous. Or you know, Flickr. You know, and Airbnb. People are gonna get in there and get murdered and raped in there. No one wants that. And so, you know, you never know. You know, Snapchat, the dick pic app. No one wants that. And then, you know, so there's a lot of things that people don't know, even in the pros, including me. But we'll see. That could be wrong. We talk a lot about self-driving cars. We had a small discussion about this before. I think we touched on this thing before, but this is a new thing in Wired that sort of touches on the idea that self-driving cars are doing so well, and they've logged literally a million miles, hundreds and thousands of miles between some of these cars without incident. But what it's boiling down to, people are saying that for them to be 100% safe, someone's got to die. I guess they're saying for them to be 100% safe, there's going to be a point in a world of self-driving cars where the car will have to make a decision between the driver and the person outside.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a situation where there's a person in the street, mm-hmm. you can hit that person and the driver can survive, or you can swerve, miss the person and fly off a cliff. You know, someone's gonna die, either you in the car. Now, if I'm driving the car and my robot threw me off a cliff, you know, I would be very upset. You know, I'll also be very upset if I'm
talking, terms and conditions.
If I look up and I run over someone because the robot said, "Hey, it's them or you, right. Keep it moving." Like, I don't know. I mean, this is the thing, and this is like you. This is the things that are happening. Like, you know, auto travel is one of the leading causes of death. You know, in every year, bigger than terrorist attacks and plane crashes and everything else
combined.
And this is because there's a lot of tough choice. There's a lot of negligence and drunkenness and some abuse substances and stuff like that and recklessness. But there's also like weird tough choices people have to make. There's accidents. Things happen. So having a computer will not eliminate some of those things. It will greatly decrease them, but won't eliminate them. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think about this?
I mean, I think it's a topic of ethics and how do these autonomous devices or these autonomous technologies, understand ethically what is correct or what is the best choice. And I think, we kind of give away some of our rights when we hop into, a system, a vehicle or whatever that, we don't have full control over. So I think, like I said, terms and conditions. If you're going to purchase a self-driving car, then you might have to run the risk of that car deciding to kill you versus kill the kid that's walking across the street. So, I mean, I think that, again, I think that the computer is able to, make these mathematical choices and decisions way faster than we are able to as humans. But it still can make mistakes. And
sure.
I think that's just a part of transportation. That's a part of figuring out a way to move a large mass of people at the same time. I think that's a part of it. So I think we'll just have to accept that as we, become more comfortable with the self-driving autonomous vehicles, in our world. So,
and we're only talking about human beings. We're not taking it down a rung and saying, what if there's a cat in the road, or a dog in the road, or a deer?
But how does it know? How does it know that it's a deer or a child? How does it? How can it?
Exactly. Like, so that it,
makes separation
it,
of that.
Second, how do you analyze that as a deer versus a child? And then, is it okay to run over the deer but not the child?
Right.
Like, oh, if it's a child, I'm gonna stop. If it's a deer, I'm plowing through.
Right.
Whatever. Like a child versus a small like a cat or a dog. I should say, because a deer is a deer. Anyway, a deer will take you out. That's all interesting. We'll see. And it can't give the control back to you because I might be asleep.
How does that work, like, for insurance or like lawsuits? Like, you killed my kid or my dad died.
I didn't do it.
Right.
Mercedes Technologies
did.
Like I
said, terms and conditions.
Yeah, I was asleep. I was my own business. Anyway. All right. Well, I don't know. That's very true. I'm personally not a huge fan of the autonomous cars. I'm really sort of afraid to get behind the wheel of one of those joints.
But you're not afraid to hop in an airplane. I don't get it.
Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. doesn't make any sense whatsoever. This is people
or a train and subway. All of those are autonomous. A guy sits back and is reading a newspaper as driving.
No, man, he's up there. Like, he's
okay.
He's driving. I gotta believe that. All right. Visa has a new method of payment. Allegedly, this is I don't quite understand. This is as a prototype, kind of in the vein of these sort of Snapchat glasses and other glasses and Google Glass. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how, I don't know I don't know what the ceiling is on these new Snapchat glasses and this sort of augmented reality and Google Glass, return of Google Glass technology. But Visa seems to be thinking that it's something they want to use. They have these glasses, Ray-Ban style, where they have actual Visa thing on your glasses where you can go to a lot of these pay things, take off your glasses and pay for something that right then and there. That, for me, who loses glasses every 5 seconds, and also that just seems like a nightmare. I mean, your phone's one thing, your fingerprints on it, but your glasses?
Yeah.
Is it hooked to your retina? Is it hooked to your... That just seems like a disaster, right?
Super disaster. However, it is prepaid, so you preload it. I put $100 on my glasses. Like, it's so ridiculous just to say it. Like, yeah, man, I paid for dinner.
Yeah, I got the glasses fly table. I got this one.
That's retarded.
Five glasses fall on the table. I don't know. Or the bill comes, you take off your glasses, put it on the tray, and you take that away. Like, how do you...
That's so stupid.
I mean, I guess these things are only as good as the method of the point of sale thing.
Right.
But... I don't know. I just don't know a scenario. I mean, maybe I guess the only way this works is on vacation somewhere. You know, you're out on vacation, you like having a couple drinks.
You don't want, you know, a wallet on you. I get that. Yeah, that makes sense.
That makes sense. But
am I going to pay for that for a vacation that I might take once or twice a year,
and
if that?
And by the way, if I'm a, you know, if I'm trying to do some dirt, if I'm a criminal and I'm like checking
you out. Get
that
nigga's glasses.
If I see someone like, I'm like, okay. Like, I don't have to get his wallet or his card. I just snatch his glasses and keep it moving. That might be easier. You know,
that's out of control.
Anyway, I don't know. Visa, tell us something. I don't think we're buying this one.
Do you take MasterCard or Visa glasses?
It's
like,
ridiculous.
What?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I can't.
Your boy Lee Daniels is at South by Southwest, and you know, he had a lot to say. He had sort of an impromptu speech. He really had an emotional sort of impromptu conversation and about Gabrielle Cibede, but he also talked a lot about how the Trump era will produce some of our greatest art, because usually art comes from this sort of like upheaval. What do you think of Daniels? What do you think of that statement?
Oh, I agree with that statement. I think it's a headline statement, obviously, but I definitely agree with that. I feel like we're in a protest environment, and I mean, you just look around in our own city, you see a lot of, you know, creatives and artists that are really expressive of, and politicizing their expressions. And I think that is the beauty of being in such a salacious and polarizing time. Like, I feel like it's good, because we want to be visually stimulated and have things that not only entertain us, but also educate us and feed us knowledge that will help, you know, shift, you know, consciousness and shift policies and shift, you know, the direction that we're taking this country and world. So I sign me up for that statement. That's a statement I would make, you know?
Right. I agree wholeheartedly. So we'll see. I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, Lee Daniels is known as a bit of a provocateur, not only in his work and his words, but I don't think this is that provocative of a statement. Mm-hmm. This is sort of spot on. I want to move on to the story about Scott Stuber moving over to from Paramount to run Netflix's film initiative. But that's not necessarily the story here. I guess the story for me is that Netflix is really getting dead serious about doing big time movies. They were dabbling in this stuff. Like, if the first big deal they did was Adam Sandler, you know, and sort of doing a bunch of weird Adam Sandler movies, which made sense, because Adam Sandler had a formula. He had a formula. He would do these movies for, you know, $30 million, $50 million, and then they would all make $120 million. Right. And so he did that for years and years and years. I mean, first he was making them for $20, they'd make $100 million, they'd make them for $30, they'd make $100 million, make them for $50, make $100 million. So now he just had Netflix give him a bunch of money, give me $200 million, and I'll make a bunch of movies. So. Right. Good for him. Now Netflix is saying, and other agents and stars are saying, why can't we apply that same thing to other genres? Why couldn't that work for a Will Smith, exactly, a Brad Pitt, Martin Scorsese?
It's already working for Will Smith.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is interesting. So this guy, Scott Stuber, is going to come in and he's going to shepherd that. And it just signals that Netflix is now going to operate like a traditional movie studio.
Yeah.
I mean, because you have it already as, you know, the one thing that Netflix was a technology company turned sort of DVD delivery system, turned streaming delivery service, turned network, really, turned original content network.
Yeah.
Now, turn movie studio, because the business of creating original content as a television studio, as a television production company, which essentially Netflix was, and then shifting over into we're a movie studio doing big movies, seems to be a big shift.
But I feel like the whole Netflix model, I wouldn't even call them a traditional, you know, television studio or network. In the sense that, I mean, the whole Netflix and chill and, you know, binge watching, you know, all that is part of the Netflix culture, and to be able to create, you know, something that is episodic but it has movie quality throughout the whole thing, I feel like that was already a part of the inner workings of it. I think what you're saying is absolutely accurate, in the sense that, you know, they're dominating in that sector, and now to be able to say full-fledged, like, we're going to bring in the best talent, you know, from an executive down to, you know, acting to directors, to be able to also build out, you know, these crazy classic flagship movies. I think it works perfectly for what they're doing. Like, they're trying to like literally dominate the whole entire video industry.
Yeah,
you know?
Are video games next,
or sports?
Or sports next? Right. I mean, I don't know how they're going to crack sports, because you know Netflix can't do live.
Right.
But I'm sure they'll figure something out. I mean, video game industry is also an industry where people laugh at the video game industry, but you know, you may spend $200 million on, or $150 million on a Halo, or $200 million on a Halo developing game like Halo, Grand Theft Auto, and then
be able to play it on Netflix.
Yeah, but the profit margins for those are insane. Like those at $60 a unit, they're making $1 billion. You know, they debut to $1 billion, like larger than any movie could ever. So I wonder what's next. Just to reiterate, coming up to Netflix, obviously you have the $90 million Will Smith movie, Bright.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Scorsese's long gestating real life gangster movie, The Irishman, where they're aging and de-aging. Joe Pesci, Joe Pesci, Al Pacino, and Robert De Niro.
Right.
Again, all those people who wanted to see what would it be like with a young Robert De Niro acting against a young, you know, Al Pacino. Well, you're going to see it, because they're both going to de-age, acting themselves. It's a weird, you know, it's a good moment, because it's them,
right,
and it's them acting it up,
right,
but you're going to see them young every stage of the career. So all that stuff we missed out on the last 40 years of their career, we get to see it, hopefully, directed by Martin Scorsese, along with Joe Pesci. Last but not least, Brad Pitt. It's got a comedy called War Machine, like a huge comedy. So I mean, this game is bigger than Scorsese, you know, Will Smith and Brad Pitt. I mean, yeah, Netflix is making moves. This is not Adam Sandler. This is some big moves here. So good for them. Speaking of movies, last but not least, I want to get out of here and talk about these last trailers. I'm gonna give you these movies and see if you've seen any of them at all. Let's start with the Fast 8 trailer with your boy Tyrese.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Are you excited about it? Are you in those movies?
I mean, yeah, I think you know they serve a purpose. You
okay.
know, I feel like, I mean, they're not the best example of filmmaking, but I think in terms of just great entertainment, yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah,
right.
I mean, we've kind of grown up on them, so.
Right. Okay. So the Deadpool. Is that a new trailer? Or is it the same teaser that was before Wolverine?
I haven't seen anything new Deadpool.
Okay, so I have to check on that. This is what I'm really excited about. Atomic Blonde. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I have.
It's from the dude. So you know, it's
whooping ass.
The John Wick guys, basically. The John Wick was directed by two guys. It was directed by Keanu Reeves' old two Keanu Reeves stunt coordinators, and they one directed, one kind of ghost directed it.
Right.
I don't think there was a falling out, but one went on to do John Wick 2, and the other went on to do this one, Atomic right. Blonde. It's basically female John Wick. It looks dope.
Yep.
The Get Down Part 2 is coming back. We know that. A funny movie called Rough Night, which looks very funny, kind of like a I don't know, Bridesmaids with a twist, with Scarlett Johansson and Alana from Broad City and my girl Kate McKinnon. Handmaid's Tale, which I don't know about. But one thing we didn't talk about is none of the stuff I care about. Oh, Geostorm, which looks ridiculous. Did you see that one?
I have not.
Okay, it's just another, like, you know, the worst storm in history. Weather satellites controlling tornadoes. Anyway, it's ridiculous. Anyway, but one thing we didn't talk about is the potential reboot of The Matrix. The Matrix,
right.
Warner Brothers is talking about trying to figure out. Now, I'm not really mad at Warner Brothers. People really freaked out by this. You can't do this. You can't do this. But look, it's Warner Brothers' job to figure out how to make money. They're not saying they're going to bring back, reboot The Matrix with new people. But that universe, that rich universe created by the Wachowskis, now sisters, not brothers. We call them the both women now. Created by the Wachowskis, it's a deep universe. And if they want to go back to that universe and world and do other things, it's their prerogative to do so.
100%.
Right? I don't think it's bad. People are really mad about this, but no one's saying we're going to redo The Matrix. We're just saying that they say they may open up The Matrix universe.
Yeah, like tell the origin stories of Morpheus.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll be fresh.
A young Morpheus, exactly. A young Niobe.
Right.
You know, so I want to see all that. I'm saying it's all of them. So we will see. We'll see. I think that's all I got. That's all. Anything else?
Yeah. What was it? I think that was it, man. I was gonna ask you about Have you heard about? I think it's Cadillac that is saying they're gonna do the Netflix version of being able to get into a new vehicle, meaning that you can, I guess, lease for a month a new.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's like the Netflix of Cadillacs, right?
Exactly.
It's like the you can lease any, like you can, today I want the STS, today exactly. I want the Escalade, today exactly. I want the whatever.
Exactly.
For $1,500 a month.
Right.
That's not bad.
Not bad.
That's not bad.
It's an interesting concept.
It's an interesting concept. I wonder if BMW and Mercedes and all right. others will adopt that same thing.
Right.
And what do you turn in your cars? You go to a local dealer.
Right.
Is it like a rental? That's an interesting thing.
Absolutely.
How does insurance work? But yeah, all that is great. I love it. I love that concept.
Absolutely.
You know, you whip a new Cadillac every day.
Right.
So anyway, $1,500 and some leases are like Cadillac leases are like $1,100.
Right exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know. Anyway, all right. That's all I got. I like that one. Where can the people find you, sir?
People can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Akili Shine, AKILISHINE. Where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Joe K. Braswell and on Snapchat at J. Braz. Thank you for joining us. We will be back next week with more tech stories. And that's all I got. See you soon. Bye.
From executives Kevin Undergaro, Dario Kristen, Tiana Hobson, and the entire BHL staff, we would like to thank you for supporting Black Hollywood Live, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. For questions and comments, contact us. info@blackhollywoodlive.com. Like us on Facebook, tweet us, or Instagram us at BHL Online. And I am the official voice of Black Hollywood Live, Scipio, Instagramming at KingXOBay. Thanks for tuning in.
Hollywood Redefined.
The views expressed here are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.